Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with today's sentencing of Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, who, after being sentenced to 47 months last week, is now facing 7.5 years in prison unless he is pardoned, which is increasingly likely given Trump's rhetoric of late. Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who is an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion, who spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, joins us to discuss how President Trump has been laying the groundwork for pardoning Manafort by talking like a mob boss, calling Michael Cohen, his former fixer who testified against him, a rat, while praising Manafort as a good stand-up guy who has been treated unfairly. The fact that Manafort did not pay taxes on $55 million he had hid offshore from the IRS does not appear to bother Trump or the judge who sentenced Manafort last week, claiming he had, quote, led an otherwise blameless life. But more details of Manafort's corruption and treachery are likely to come out soon in the Mueller report, and the question then arises how much of the report will the public see after surviving the heavy redactions from the intelligence community, since the evidence will largely come from the counterintelligence investigation of Trump and his Russian connections launched in 2016, which continues to this day. Then we will speak with Susan Crawford, the John A. Reilly Clinical Professor at Harvard Law School and author of the new book just out, Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. She joins us to discuss what is behind the battle between the U.S. government and Huawei, the Chinese telecom giant, which is on the cutting edge of building a global infrastructure for the next fifth generation or 5G communications network. We will look into whether threatening allies to not go with Huawei rather than providing a better and cheaper alternative American product is going to work. And since 5G cannot work without high-speed internet service, again we find the U.S. with a 26 megabit average internet speed lags behind in 1 gigabit service because of the short-term profiteering of cable and telecom monopolies and the failure of the federal government to invest in infrastructure. Then finally, Angus Johnson, a professor of history at the City University of New York, where he researches student activism and student government and has a large Twitter following at Student Activism, joins us. We will discuss the scandalous revelations following the indictments of wealthy and connected parents who used shady college counseling businesses to get their kids into prestigious colleges and universities. Since Jared Kushner's dad pledged $2.5 million to get him into Harvard, one wonders why Rick Singer of Newport Beach was paid as much as $6.5 million to place a rich kid rather than have the parents donate the money to Harvard. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery. And currently he serves as the ADA Counsel and is chair of Tax Justice Network USA and the Violence Policy Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jack Blum.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you, Jack. And what did you make of the sentencing today, the second sentencing of Paul Manafort by U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson? She could have given him 10 years, but she basically gave him, four.
About four, which will mean he's got a total sentence of about 7.5 years.
Right.
Because the important thing is that it was to be consecutive rather than concurrent.
Right.
So that this sentence is piled on top of the other sentence.
Right.
Frequently, they allow criminal defendants to have concurrent sentences so that the totals don't add up. So he's getting a pretty substantial punishment here. And if you think about his age as he goes into this, and his age coming out of it, and his general condition of health, it's a pretty fair sentence. I mean, this guy's having a big chunk of the rest of his life, if not the rest of his life, as a guest of the federal government under circumstances which are far from pleasant.
Right, and then no parole in the federal system, right?
No parole in the federal system. He'll get some time off for good behavior, presumably.
And time served, I think, right?
Time served, of course. But time served is time served. It isn't exactly
he's
out on a frolic.
Right.
So, all told, it's probably a fair sentence for the crimes he committed. The much more serious question is Trump flipping around with this issue of pardon. He's got his people talking about it. He's talking about it. He's saying the treatment was unfair, that he's been picked on. And really what's going on is Trump is positioning himself to reward the guy who, as he put it, didn't rat. And unlike the other guy, Cohn, who he called a rat.
Right.
And the contrast between the way he refers to these two is really stark and something that people should pay attention to. Because if anything, the crimes that were committed by Manafort are crimes that were at least, if not more serious, than anything Cohn did. Cohn was a kind of relatively low-level fixer who was dealing with other low-level people to protect Trump, going around acting as a bully and a thug, while Manafort was acting as a foreign agent and really was an arm of the Russian government. To me, that's a far more serious proposition. But here's Trump, who's looking at it through the eyes of, this guy protected me and the other guy flipped. And I'm going to get even by pardoning the guy who took care of me and ignoring the guy who flipped.
Well, the U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson, in handing down the sentence, did scold Manafort's lawyers, saying that they made these claims in the hopes of winning a pardon for President Trump. The no collusion.
It's obvious.
Yeah.
It's obvious that that was what was going on. His lawyer steps out of the court and says, well, it proves no collusion, and the question of collusion never came up.
Right. So she's on to them. Do you think Trump is going to make an announcement soon then?
It's hard to say. It's going to depend on what he thinks he can get away with and when he thinks he can get away with it. So it might be something he does in the middle of some other crisis where he's carrying center stage and everybody in the news business is too busy or too preoccupied to really focus on it. But he may also do it in the middle of the night in the form of a tweet.
Well, Manafort today in court came in a wheelchair, and he did in the previous sentencing with the very much more sympathetic judge. Apparently he's in a wheelchair because his lawyers say it's due to gout. Gout, of course, can be treated with medication.
Sure.
It's mostly diet-related, and basically rich English squires who eat too much pheasant and drink too much port tend to be subject to it. This guy's not having rich food in prison, surely. So
no, he's not having rich food in prison, but I would say that if you looked at him or heard about his being described by people who saw him in the courtroom and around, he's not a well man. Whether it's gout, whether it's something else, my guess is that he's not getting the most sophisticated diagnostic treatment in jail, nor is he getting the most sophisticated medical help. He doesn't exactly have the ability to go to a major teaching hospital and have them do a full workup. And people who've looked at him say that he looks pretty ill. Now, maybe it's gout, maybe it's something else. It really doesn't much matter. I don't think there's much question that the guy is not well. And he certainly has taken a deep fall from his former life.
And again, I'm speaking with Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who is an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and he serves as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery. So if Trump is poised to pardon Manafort, when you say that he doesn't look well and prison's not exactly top-notch medical treatment and, of course, the diet's not great, my sense is, though, I believe he's under special protection from the Marshals Service. You know, he owes this Russian oligarch, Deripaska, he owes him, I think, close to $20 million. And you don't want to owe that guy money, I guarantee you.
Well, I think given what he was doing for Deripaska and how Deripaska was trying to stay out of the limelight, and given the amount of money Deripaska has, I don't think that that's as dangerous as it might be, for example, if he owed $20 million to a Mexican drug cartel. Right. They are very unforgiving. They chop his head off and put it in a cooler with some ice. The Deripaska won't do that. He'll just let it fly by because he doesn't want anybody to realize fully what he's been up to. To come back to the sentencing, the part of this whole story that really is most obnoxious as far as I'm concerned is the way Judge Ellis really blew off the seriousness of the tax evasion charges. The amount of money that this guy hid from IRS and the way he did it is a major criminal piece of business. And he should have been sentenced much more heavily, I think, on that and with a real admonition from the judge about the seriousness of the tax crime.
Right.
Because everything he did is sort of classic and obvious use of an international system that very wealthy people have used to avoid taxation. And if there are light sentences or the judge fails to sort of put down the hammer on it, other rich people figure, hey, we'll get away with this. And if they finally do catch up with us, it's considered something that we'll get punished for, and it'll be like a parking ticket. And we really can't have that, or else the system is going to go to hell.
Well, the fact of the matter is, Jack Blum, that Manafort hid $55 million offshore from the IRS.
Precisely.
$55 million. And the judge said he has led an otherwise blameless life? I mean...
Setting up offshore structures to hide $55 million in income is not an otherwise blameless life. And to say that, well, there was no violence connected with it, I'm not even sure that's true, but let's say there's a form of violence in not paying what you owe to the government and then putting money with people who are obviously criminals who are trying to assist you in the tax evasion. And make no mistake, the people who are assisting, the structure that makes all this possible, is also criminal. It is a felony to assist someone in the evasion of tax. And that means that there were a lot of other people who were playing in this who weren't charged and certainly weren't sentenced. But that underscores the importance of talking about all of this in the sentencing and paying attention to those crimes and treating them as if they're real.
So do you think, though, that before Trump pardons Manafort, the full story is going to come out about the extent to which he is, to put it bluntly, likely to be a traitor, that he's essentially worked for the Kremlin? I've spoken to people who knew him in Ukraine who said that he was the PR guy or the media guy for Yanukovych, the Russian puppet.
Right.
And he had his Russian media account. And I've been told that there's no way in the world that you could have Russian media and not have a relationship with the Kremlin. And then we learn that his deputy, Konstantin Kalimnin, is, according to the FBI, GRU officer with Russian military intelligence. This guy is clearly an asset of the Kremlin. I mean, do you think that...
That's a fair assessment.
Right, but does is Mueller going to ever get this stuff out before Trump pardons him? Because
that's a real question, and I can't fully get my head around what's going to happen. Because on one hand, the question is, does Mueller consider his brief to be only looking at crimes, or is he going to tell the full story? Because if it's only looking at crimes, the issue of reporting as a foreign agent is the best you can do. It's not a crime to be an agent of a foreign government if you report it. And it may be that if Mueller's brief is only to figure out what criminal acts were committed, the guy may skate, and Mueller may not actually tell us a whole lot about what was done on behalf of the Russians.
Well, we learned, though, in an earlier court filing that Mueller's chief investigator, Andrew Weissman, said to the judge that what they were dealing with in terms of focusing on Manafort's relationship to Kalimnik gets to the heart of our inquiry.
Yeah. And that, of course, is true, but now what of that is going to be in a report, or how much of that is going to be made public is another open question. And that's the thing that worries me. A lot of what has gone on, remember, in these filings by Mueller's team has been kept classified, blacked out. And some of the documents are more blacked-out pages than there are pages that are readable. And the question is, when will we see what's under the blackouts?
Well, that is, of course, Barr's discretion. And the only thing that I understand that in the rules of the Justice Department, you're not allowed to indict a sitting president. But apparently, whatever Barr turns Mueller down for, that information has to be sent to the House and Senate Judiciary Committee. So that was the only way we'd know if...
For sure.
If Mueller was turned down by Barr, if there's somebody he wanted to investigate, etc.
The other part of that problem what can be disclosed has to do with sources and methods. And I'm virtually certain that what the FBI had was some kind of intelligence intercept of some of the communications between the Manafort people, the Russians, and even the campaign. So underneath it, there may actually be hard evidence that there was collusion and people were talking to each other, which no one can put before the American public because the sources and methods are both highly sensitive and real national security issues.
Well, that's the real crux, isn't it? How do you translate classified information into a legal case, and particularly when most of this classified information that will be heavily redacted is the counterintelligence investigation? That seems to be really where the heart of this is, right?
I agree that is where the heart of it is, and I think it's why, for example, the investigation of was Trump an agent of a foreign power as a counterintelligence matter was started, that they must have seen material and intercepts and other things that tell them, A, the Russians thought that he was, even if maybe he wasn't, or that there were some direct communications that they saw that said, hey, we know something here, and we better figure out how to come up with that information using another method.
Well, just in closing, we know that a counterintelligence investigation into Trump's Russian contacts began in 2016 when he fired Comey, and we know that McCabe and Rosenstein wrestled with it. So my understanding is, and I don't know what yours is, Jack, but that investigation did not end.
I think you're right that it didn't end. The question is, what can be seen and what can we know?
Well, Jack Blum, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Jack Blum, who's a Washington lawyer, who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and serves as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery. And currently he serves as the ADA Counsel and is chair of Tax Justice Network USA and the Violence Policy Center. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Susan Crawford, the John A. Reilly Clinical Professor at Harvard Law School and a regular contributor to Wired. She served as Special Assistant to the President for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy and co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administrations, and is the author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. And her latest book just out is Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution, and Why America Might Miss It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Crawford.
Thank you.
And there is clearly a battle underway between the White House and Huawei, the very successful Chinese telecom company. Around the world, the U.S. is lobbying the governments of the U.K., Poland, Germany, etc., not to go with Huawei's infrastructure, which apparently is a lot cheaper and apparently works very well. But is it true that in terms of this new generation of wireless connectivity called 5G, that in this world where cyber is so important, it's in particularly in cyber military is considered the new frontier, if you will. So is it true that whichever country dominates 5G will gain an economic intelligence and military edge for much of this century?
Well, it's absolutely true that this is both an economic and strategic question. And it may be that for the United States, the economic issues are even greater than the strategic ones. Although it's true that Huawei essentially is China. There's no real separation. And the reason the Huawei gear is so much cheaper is that 20 to 30% of its cost is subsidized by the Chinese government. So people are having to choose between, let's say, patriotism and profits, which is tough for a lot of Western European countries. So the United States is trying to persuade them not to go with Huawei. At the same time, there's a real economic interest here that goes beyond surveillance. The new protocol for very advanced wireless, people call it 5G, allows for complete control over what services are allowed to be delivered to people over those connections to rest in the hands of the wireless carrier. And so to the extent China can not only provide 5G to its giant geographic marketplace, but also to the 80-plus countries of the Belt Road Initiative, which represent about 65% of the global population, that gives China essentially enormous control over what new services get introduced and who gets to make money from advanced wireless services, and the U.S. companies won't necessarily be able to enter that market. So it's lots of things. It's surveillance, it's the lack of a separation between the country China and the business Huawei, and a real desire on the part of the United States not to cede the entire global territory to China.
So how do you separate the strategic and military out from the economic? In other words, if the U.S. is lagging, the concern with the intelligence community is that all of these systems can have a backdoor built in where data is then taken out the back door and siphoned off by Chinese intelligence. But if you become ubiquitous and capture the world market, that also obviously gives you an economic leg up and I assume concurrently a military advantage. So it's a two-pronged situation, right?
Yeah, it really is, because you could think of that backdoor surveillance. You could also think of it as just the ability to apply analytics or artificial intelligence to data passing over those networks, which will give enormous market opportunities for targeting advertising and deeply locational services. And all of that, absent some decision not to go with Huawei, will rest in the hands of the Chinese government.
And that is what's referred to as the system of surveillance capitalism, which is essentially the business model for Amazon and Facebook and Google, is it not?
Sure. They're trying to give it, you know, there are lots of buzzwords to apply to it. It's applying analytics to data. And the current concern over Facebook and Google in many countries in the world is that they have access to so much data that they can routinely undersell, and particularly the case of Amazon, serve as both marketplace and as vendor of products in ways that make it very difficult for anybody else to enter those markets. And now those concerns are being raised up a notch with the potential capability of China, through its government enterprises, to serve as the arbiter of what succeeds and what fails online.
So in other words, Chinese 5G, if it becomes a global infrastructure, would leapfrog over the monopolistic powers that already exist with Facebook, Google, and Amazon.
Yeah, I don't really focus much on Facebook, Netflix, and Google, and Amazon, to tell you the truth, because I'm so concerned about infrastructure,
right?
Because it's basic. Netflix and Amazon need this infrastructure in order to reach customers. And if that infrastructure ceases to be available to the private marketplace, you know, if you really can't introduce a new product or service without the cooperation of the Chinese government, that's a big area of concern. So, look, it's a huge topic, and I know that the military part of this is also a deep concern, that, you know, how could we possibly have a Chinese company and essentially China itself able to listen to everything and avoid, frankly, our listening to them? That's also a big part of their concern. Our military wants to be able to hear what they're up to. So it's an arms race, and it's being cloaked right now in questions of what gear to buy and what networks to rely on. But it's really about the battle between what appears to be the waning empire, the United States, and the rising empire, which is China.
So let's talk about fiber in the sense that the new 5G wireless systems, which apparently are much less intrusive, they don't involve these big towers that cell phones have, but they do also need strong, fast internet, or they won't work. And isn't that a real problem in this country? We have a national average of internet speed of about 26 megabytes. In much of the world, they have a gigabyte, 1,000 megabytes, Finland, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, I think even France. A lot of countries have it. We have it only in places like Chattanooga, where they've been quite prescient about it's a municipal service as opposed to a tech monopoly. My understanding is, for example, the former head at Verizon, who championed Fios, which is a fiber optic infrastructure system, he was fired by Wall Street because, you know, they want short-term profits and he was investing too much money. So is that the mentality in this country, that our telecom monopolies simply are just cheap? They don't invest in infrastructure unless they really are forced to. And meanwhile, countries like China, where infrastructure is subsidized, are stealing a march on us.
Look, the real thing to focus on here is that China aims to have 80% of its population connected to fiber optic networks and advanced wireless. And also, we'll do the same in the ports and infrastructure areas it's serving with the Belt Road Initiative, which is enormous. By contrast, the U.S., at best, we think, will perhaps have 13% of homes connected to fiber optic, and it's very expensive in America. And it's not because our companies in the U.S. are bad at all. It's just that we have not had any form of industrial policy about the level of service that everyone gets to expect in their house and the cheapness of that level of service. We have this for electricity in America and for clean water and sewage systems, but not because of historical failures on the federal government's part for very high-capacity Internet access. And this does mean that we're suffering from lots of digital divides between us and China, certainly in the future, currently South Korea, Japan, Sweden, places like that, that have very, very high fiber adoption. It's also very cheap there, $30 for gigabit symmetric service. We can't even imagine that here. It's possible in those other countries because the government has made a level playing field on which the private sector operates. And they've insisted on treating high-speed Internet access and fiber in particular as infrastructure. Here we don't do that. We treat it as a luxury. And you're right that without fiber very deep into neighborhoods across the country, 5G just doesn't function. There'll be so much data collected and thrown off by the small cells, and by the way, they're not intrusive, they're quite large, that make up 5G that we'll have to have fiber or it just is not going to function. Other countries understand this. We just haven't moved to that realization yet in the U.S.
Well, I know, for example, Australia had the Labor government had a plan to wire the whole country with fiber, and the Conservative government came in and decided to save money by making copper the last mile.
Yes.
So that is, look, the worst of all worlds, right?
Yes. So, yeah, they essentially retained the prior monopoly by doing that.
Right.
And didn't manage to increase their speeds. And the Labor plan was adopted pretty early in the game, and with a lot of enthusiasm, and I thought it was a very good plan. And the fact that it didn't succeed, because, among other things, Rupert Murdoch didn't want to see it succeed, is too bad for Australia and traps them in their current situation.
So,
the United States doesn't have to be trapped, and I have hope that we'll figure this out.
Well, Rupert Murdoch is Trump's closest advisor. So.
Yeah, there you are.
He is a malignant force, shall we say, globally. So what do you think, Ken? I mean, your book is obviously is a wake-up call to people and policymakers. But, you know, there were an awful lot of Americans opposed Ajit Pai's getting rid of net neutrality. There's so many citizens clamoring to let the FCC know that they don't want them to do this. Obviously, Ajit Pai and the people behind him didn't give a damn, and they ignored the lobbying from citizens and went ahead and did what they did. By the way, this has got to be the most negligent FCC. Not only have they destroyed net neutrality, they've also allowed telemarketers to take over. I mean, I don't know how many telemarketing calls you get per day, but it makes me nuts, and everybody I talk to. And that is, you know, so you've got a bunch of bottom feeders now being empowered by the Trump administration while we're losing ground, as we are discussing in this conversation about the next generation 5G and the lack of high-speed Internet in this country itself.
Well, this is becoming a very important issue for the coming 2020 presidential election. Certainly at the local level in every state, there are hundreds of cities looking hard at this and trying to make sure that all of their citizens have a decent, respectable, and very cheap Internet access connection. There are more than 800 locations across the United States that are working on creating what are essentially public options fiber networks, controlled or at least overseen by the government. And it's an issue of great concern, not only at the local level, but increasingly at the federal level as well. So I have, again, hopes that that the real issue here, which is absence of market policy for Internet access, will be taken up in the coming years. Net neutrality really has little to do with that, because even fixing those net neutrality rules would not allow for market entry by cheaper competitors, would not allow for, or not certainly not require, very high-capacity fiber connections at low cost to Americans. So we have a long way to go, but this issue is becoming a key progressive staple, really a column of what's going to be important for the United States in the coming years.
But how much, I was under the impression, Susan Crawford, that there's an awful lot of fiber that's already been laid down. It's just the monopolies controlling the last mile. Is it? We know about Chattanooga and a couple of other cities, I think, have got, and by the way, the city of Santa Monica have introduced gigabyte internet, and it's attracting business from all over the place.
Yes, that's right. No, there are 800 of these places or more, and there are more and more every day. And I was just speaking to the National League of Cities meeting yesterday in Washington, and there were gazillions of mayors who were interested in this and understand that this is a very popular thing to talk about for their citizens, because really no one is on the other side other than AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, CenturyLink, and Charter. So,
and by the way, nobody likes their cable service.
Right, exactly. Well, it's just too expensive and second rate, and the customer service often is not great. And as people wake up and understand that actually, both as a nation, we're suffering from this divide with other countries, and then internally, there are harrowing divides between poor people in America and richer people with a better service, although they're paying too much for it, and rural people often with no service at all. So we clearly have to fix this, just as we did electricity and the telephone. These are basic affordances of modern life. And we, you know, just as we need bridges and roads, we need publicly overseen fiber wholesale access across the United States so that everybody gets cheap service. It will happen eventually because we're the place that came up with the idea of the Internet. There was a time when we beat back tyranny around the world. You know, we built a federal highway system. We can do great things. And so I'm not giving up until we get this issue right.
But in the last 30 seconds, it would seem that if this government, the Trump administration, is making such a fuss over China stealing a march on 5G, how can they ignore the fiber optic need for high-speed internet? Because you can't have one without the other.
Humans are capable of enormous self-deception.
Well, yes, I think with our narcissist in chief, this may be a situation that is almost unprecedented, having a leader with such peculiar personality quirks, to be polite. Well, Susan Crawford, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I'm speaking with Susan Crawford, who's a John A. Riley Clinical Professor at Harvard Law School and a regular contributor to Wired. She served as Special Assistant to the President for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy and co-led the FCC transition team between the Bush and Obama administrations and is the author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. And her latest book just out is Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Angus Johnson, a professor of history at the City University of New York, where he researches student activism and student government. You can find him on Twitter at Student Activism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Angus Johnson.
Thanks for having me.
And Angus, what's your sense then of where this college admission scandal is heading? I'm told, and I've been in researching this, a lot of people have said, well, you know, the rich and powerful and the connected have always had an advantage and there's nothing new about it. I guess the brazen nature of it is, and the emergence of these kind of middleman consultants that wealthy people hire to get their kids into Ivy League schools, maybe that's something new. So for somebody that's been involved in education and in education reform for some time, Angus, how does it strike you?
What's fascinating to me about this particular scandal is that, you know, as you say, that hiring consultants to help you get your your children into fancy colleges is something that has been around for quite a while and has certainly been becoming more and more common. But what we have here is a consultant who you're actually hiring to break the law on your behalf. And the evidence of that has been presented makes it pretty clear that these families knew that they were breaking the law. So I think what we're seeing is that these kinds of consulting organizations have become much, much more common. And what we have here is essentially a black market version of something that almost every parent is going to be doing who's similarly situated to the folks who were indicted yesterday. And so where most of their peers are going to be paying people to help them with writing their personal essays and plan out what extracurriculars they're going to get involved in and strategize with them in terms of, are you going to do a summer abroad after your junior year to help the disadvantaged in some far-off country? And, of course, also to be helping coach you for the SATs and all of that and making sure that you get the right letters of recommendation. Here, they were literally hiring people to help them break the law. But other than the fact that the services that they were providing were, in this case, literally illegal, it's not all of that different in form or content to what most of their peers would have been doing.
Well, what I find extraordinary is that Jared Kushner's father pledged $2.5 million to Harvard University to get him into Harvard. And we're learning now from this scandal that a New York-based college consultancy firm called Ivy Coach charges up to $1.5 million for its most advanced package. And they market it as a concierge service, quoting their website, the ultimate level of continuous person attention to every detail. So that's an example. But then the one down here in Newport Beach, where the owner, William Rick Singer, has been indicted. He ran a college counseling business that charged between $200,000 and $6.5 million. Now, I don't know whether that's per student. If you're going to spend $6.5 million to get your kid into an Ivy League school, wouldn't you be better off donating the money to the school itself?
You would think so. I think that one of the things that's going to come out in the days and weeks to come is a lot more information about how this scam actually worked and what was being charged for various different things. But one of the things that I suspect was going on is that if you're engaged in a criminal conspiracy, you're not actually going to be able to comparison shop, right? That if you have entered into an agreement to break the law with one of these guys, you can't shop around. And I suspect that part of what's going on is that some of these guys, once they've got a mark with deep pockets, they're just going to keep bilking them for whatever they can do. It seems pretty clear that at least some of the indicted families were shelling out a lot less. It may just be a matter of what the market will bear.
Well, some of the indicted families have lost their jobs. I mean, this guy Kaplan, he was co-chair of a global law firm, Wilkie Farr and Gallagher. He's lost his job, and maybe it's to do with breaking the law. I guess lawyers can't break the law, right? And then there's another fellow called William E. McGlashan Jr. He had a private equity firm, a TPG, and he was also on the board of STX Entertainment. He's had to step down too. So I take it that the parents, because they engage in illegal activity, are just as culpable as this Singer guy who's been collecting money hand over fist.
Well, one of the things that is extraordinary about this story is all of the different ways that they found to break the law. One of the details that I found particularly noxious is the fact that the consultancy was set up as essentially a shell company under the form of a not-for-profit corporation. And so when the parents were paying off this guy, the payments were being structured as donations to a charity, which then they could write off on their taxes. So this is tax fraud on top of everything else. And the cherry on the sundae is the fact that the foundation was ostensibly set up to provide educational opportunities to disadvantaged youth. So they were paying tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars to get their children fraudulently into these colleges and then writing it off on their taxes as donation to poor kids' educational opportunities.
Well, apparently, both Lori Loughran and her husband, the fashion designer Massimo Giannulli, they were both arrested and accused of paying $500,000 in bribes to get their two daughters accepted into USC, and they've been released on a $1 million bail. And apparently what they do is they find these sports that where there are more slots. Obviously, it'd be hard to get on the USC football team. But they got them on into USC via the rowing team. Apparently, neither of the girls had ever rowed, and they just took pictures of them on a rowing machine in a gymnasium and then photoshopped them onto a rowing team, etc. So that's the level of deceit that's going on here. So that's why Singer and company charge a lot of money, right?
Well, photoshopping. Yeah, absolutely. And what's extraordinary about this is that these are not athletic scholarships, right? That's an entirely different thing. And with an athletic scholarship, the college is going to pay much, much more attention to the quality of the athlete and all of these kinds of things. And in many of these lesser or at least less prestigious sports, you're not even going to be offering athletic scholarships for them. So this isn't a matter of pretending to be a star football player or a basketball player. This is just essentially your extracurriculars, right? Are you a well-rounded person? Are you going to contribute to the campus environment? And the fact that it was the crew team specifically is kind of fascinating to me, because a slot that is reserved for somebody on the crew team is basically affirmative action for rich people who live out in the country, right? I live in Upper Manhattan, and I teach at a community college. Nobody is going to believe that either of my daughters is a star rower for a crew team. This is something that only wealthy people would be able to do. And essentially what they did was apparently the coach just sold the slot to this grifter, and he was then able to sell it on to whichever of the families he felt was the best fit for it. It's really an extraordinary scam.
So this is trickle-down corruption then? In other words, the families pay, the rich people pay their money to the consultant. The consultant then bribes coaches in whatever sports or whatever. I mean, there are other people who have been bribed as well as coaches, right, on the college level.
Well, yes. And so, you know, the thing with the SATs is also really sorted, because what they were doing there, and this has been not all of the reporting and discussion about this has been really clear, because there's been a lot of discussion of the fact that some of these kids were essentially falsifying or apparently falsifying disabilities to have an advantage on the SATs. But what was happening was not that they were claiming disabilities so that they would have extra time, so that they would get better scores. What it was they would claim a disability, which would then entitle them to have extra time to sit for the exam, which would then mean that they couldn't just take the exam at their school or with everybody else or in a large group. And so what would happen is they would arrange to take the exam with a proctor who was secretly hired by this consultant. And so they would do however well they did, and then the proctor would take the exam, and before submitting it to the testing organization, he would correct as many incorrect questions as he needed to ensure that they got the right answer. So this is psychologists being paid off to falsify disability reports. This is proctors. This is all sorts of people who are part of the scam. It's a very, very sophisticated operation.
Well, this Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy's bribe, though, seems pretty egregious in the sense that they are abusing the disability accommodations provisions of the SAT in helping get their daughter into college. they bribed this guy who fixed their daughter's SAT scores, and they disguised it as a charitable donation for, quote, educational programs for disadvantaged youth. Now, and just in, I'll just read the indictment, 163. On or about February 27th, 2018, Huffman and her spouse made a purported contribution of $15,000 to KWF, that's a 501c3. On or about March 20th, 2018, Mazera sent them a letter thanking them for the purported donation and falsely stating that it would, quote, allow us to move forward with our plans to provide educational and self-enrichment programs to disadvantaged youth. The letter falsely stated that no goods or services were exchanged for the $15,000. So I guess that's doubly shameful, right? Cheating getting a tax deduction and doing it all in the name of disadvantaged youth?
Well, I guess triply shameful as well, because there is already so much suspicion of students who receive accommodations for disabilities, right? There are a lot of people who just assume that any time a student is given, extra time on a test or a note taker in class or the ability to use a laptop instead of writing notes by hand, there's a huge number of people who will just assume that any of those students who are doing this are looking for an unfair advantage. And as somebody who teaches in a community college, my experience has been frankly the opposite. There's a tremendous number of students that I have who are struggling against really overwhelming odds, and they frequently don't take accommodations that they're entitled to, and often are not even going to have been diagnosed with disabilities because of the access to health care and mental health care that is so unequal in this country. And so one of the things that I'm really afraid of is that this scam is going to be used to cast further doubt and skepticism on the millions of people with serious disabilities who depend on these accommodations to make it through higher education.
Well, just in the last few minutes, let's turn to two things. One, if there could be a silver lining in exposing this really disgraceful operation, two, the idea that you can I'm just completely lost. Thank God we're on tape. I lost my train of thought here. That the system. Well, let me say this. Just to turn to what the U.S. attorney said in the press conference announcing the indictments a couple of days ago, where he said that that these children of the wealthy and privileged and connected were taking slots in higher education and prestigious Ivy League colleges, etc., that would otherwise go to a more deserving student. And that's the real issue here. Kids from minority homes, disadvantaged backgrounds, they already come in disadvantaged because their K through 12 education, if they've gone to local schools, is nowhere near as good as the private school educations that the wealthy kids have gotten. So they're disadvantaged out of the gate. But if they're really good and bright and deserving, then they get screwed because the playing field's not level once they get to college entrance.
Well, all the evidence that we have, real quantitative statistical evidence, suggests that if you want to go to a prestigious college, you are far better off being a mediocre student from a wealthy family than an excellent student from a poor family. That is just beyond dispute. And I think that's not just a matter of, access to educational advantages and all of that. It's just the entire system is rigged in favor of the wealthy and powerful. Ben Dreyfus was on Twitter, Richard Dreyfus's kid, talking about his experience having flunked out of one high school and gone to another where he left under a cloud of drug use, and then finally finished at a correspondence school and then got into a fairly prestigious college. And all, he didn't have to pull any strings. He just had to write an admissions essay about his, the fact that his father was an Oscar award-winning actor. And they, of course they were happy to have him. So, you know, there's all sorts of advantages that accrue without even having to work this to the wealthy and powerful. And beyond that, you know, if you have come from these one of these kinds of families, you know how to manipulate the system on your behalf. If you're the first in your family to go to college, you don't even have any idea in many cases what kind of an admissions essay to write. Everything is stacked. And what is extraordinary about this case is that, is, you know, on the one hand, it's egregious and flagrant violations of the law. But on the other hand, the what these families were doing is different, mostly just in terms of which side of the legal line it's on from other stuff that many, many families in their position are doing. The ethics of it, frankly, I don't think all that dissimilar.
And to the other question, just in closing, that is there a silver lining here? I mean, there should be investigations into this entire racket across the board. And the DOJ suits, I think, are just the beginning of opening up a whole, not just an investigation, but also a conversation. I wouldn't expect anything from the Department of Education, because it's led by Betsy DeVos, who wants to turn over public money to these evangelical schools. And worse than that, she's championing these for-profit college rip-off criminal operations that use entirely operate on taxpayer money and get a bunch of minority kids and veterans hooked on a lifetime of debt with a worthless diploma. And that is a shameful racket. So she's an absolute disgrace. Is there anywhere that a forum or some kind of investigation that's got credibility and they could force some reforms? Do you see anything in terms of a silver lining there?
Well, I think that certainly the SAT and ACT people have to be feeling publicly humiliated at this point. Their racket depends on a perception that their tests cannot be cheated and cannot be gamed in this way. So I suspect that the specific loopholes that were used to cheat on the standardized tests are likely to be closed in the very near future. And I think that those reforms are probably, in most cases, going to be pretty simple. Similarly, I think a lot of colleges are going to be cracking down on these, on the oversight of these slots for the sports teams, because this was not a matter of the college receiving money, but of the coaches receiving money under the table and tarnishing the college's reputation. So there are some very simple reforms that I think we're likely to see that will close the specific loopholes that allow this business to thrive. But as for the larger picture, I think really what's needed is a fundamental reconceptualization of how access to higher education works in this country. And the reality is that affirmative action for the wealthy and affirmative action for the powerful and connected is one of the fundamental driving principles of elite higher education in the United States. And this is certainly not going to result in that changing in anything like the near future.
Well, Angus Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
And again, I've been speaking with Angus Johnson, who's a professor of history at the City University of New York, where he researches student activism and student government. You can find him on Twitter at Student Activism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
dressed in white with a man she loved.